will always be one.
Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services will come to order. It's Thursday, April 30th.
Can you believe it's almost May?
May Day is tomorrow.
That time has flown by, and yet it seems like April Fool's Day was a lifetime ago.
Absolutely right.
I think it's still April Fool's Day, but that's a whole other subject.
It's like Groundhog Day. Okay, welcome back, everybody. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2307.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2307 prohibits health providers from practicing conversion therapy if the recipient is under 18 years old. Declares emergency is effective on passage. There is an A7 amendment which permits what is prohibited if it occurs at a place of worship. And there were a couple of citizens who appeared today, even though scheduled for a work session, who wanted to speak to the bill if the chair would entertain that. But.
What do we have? How many people?
It was just a couple of folks. Just one.
All right. Come on up.
At your discretion.
It's always good to err on the side of
Openness.
If you want to testify.
Okay. Welcome. Sorry, I will work on talking louder. But have a seat right there.
I don't know what this country boy does when he comes to town.
I've been trying to figure that out for 18 years here.
All right.
And say your name for the record.
John Chandler.
Welcome, John Chandler. We have another John Chandler around here.
J-O-N.
J-O-N.
Yeah. From Culver, Oregon.
Yeah.
I don't know where he's from.
No.
All right, I'm from Prineville, along with my bride. Anyway, I don't know a whole lot about this. You know, I just got in a little bit on it. And I understand it's to not allow counselors to counsel boys, especially under 19, about homosexuality, that the measure.
So it's a little bit different than that. You could still, teenagers could still go and talk to a counselor about their sexual identity. It would just prohibit a counselor having as their plan changing who that person is.
Depends on who the person is.
Trying to change them.
Oh. But, okay. And I come from a biblical view, you know, of what the Bible says, you know, about it. And so, as far as changing their views, by the time they get to be 19, their view's already made. But up until 19, is that right?
18.
18?
Yep.
They give them a year. Anyway, that's what I had to say, and we're very, very concerned about homosexuality and the role that it's taken in our society. And so that's why I'm here, just to find out what we can do, not to change people's minds necessarily, but to help them, guide them in the right direction as we feel the Bible dictates. And so I appreciate the chance to get to talk.
Well, thank you so much for coming all the way over, and it's very nice to make your acquaintance. All right, so we are now in a work session on House Bill 2307. I know that everybody has a number of comments that they want to make, so why don't we wait until we are on the main motion of the bill for our comments. And I believe Representative or Senator Olson, it's 10 years of Representative Olson. He's trained me. He's one of my favorite people anywhere. It's a compliment. So, Senator Olson, I understand you may have a motion to make.
I'd like to move that the A7 amendment be adopted for House Bill 2307.
So, Senator Olson moves the -7 amendment to House Bill 2307. Is there discussion? Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, it was stated that the religious exemption is in the bill by its silence. All this does is make it explicit. I think it makes it a better bill.
Any further discussion? I just want to say my understanding of the amendment is that the bill is intended to prohibit this practice by any licensed provider. And this would create exceptions to which licensed providers could. What the bill does exempt in terms of religion would be a pastor or a Sunday school teacher or a parent or a ministry of a church where that isn't being operated by a licensed mental health professional. And this bill would create those exceptions. And I am going to oppose the measure just because I think the bill is about what we're licensing as medical practice in Oregon, and I'm satisfied with the underlying bill. Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair, we just had a gentleman come forward with his religious concerns, mm-hmm. and this amendment, I feel, would answer the questions of those people that do have those religious concerns and provide them with, shall I say, a safe haven to say that, okay, my religious concerns are covered, I feel comfortable with it, and we can proceed forward with the bill. And I think this does make the bill a better bill.
All right. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, just to add to what she said, I mean, I do think that, you know, through our comments here and, you know, what I assume will be comments on the floor, you know, I think we can make it clear that what we're talking about here is, you know, conduct pursued by professionals licensed by the state. There, you know, there's nothing in this bill that prohibits, you know, individuals from informally counseling other individuals, or, you know, as was stated, somebody in their religious capacity giving advice to another person. But what we're talking about is this as a medical practice that the state is sanctioning through its licensure. So I think it would be actually misleading to incorporate this amendment.
All right, any further discussion? Seeing none, Maria, would you please call the roll?
Senator Denbrough?
No.
Senator Cruz?
Yes.
Senator Montes Anderson?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yes.
Chair Gelser?
No. Having, what do I say, not received the required majority, the motion failed. The motion fails for the amendment. All right. So for the, do you want to make the motion or do you want Senator Denbrough to make the?
I can do it.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You've noticed that I could vote no on it.
There you go.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2307A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2307A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think without the A7 amendments, this does step on religious freedom, and the bill in and of itself is quite simply because for most therapists, if they're going outside of their practice act, they will be sanctioned by their boards. I think this also steps on parental rights.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Yes.
Senator Olson.
I agree with Senator Cruz. The reason I am opposing this is, once again, we are taking the parents out of the responsibility of parenting. And as a parent, if I were a parent, and I am not a parent, but if I were and I had a child that came to me and said, Dad, I want to talk about this, I would certainly want the ability to go someplace and talk about it. And I understand what you're going to say, that this bill allows that. But the fact is that it removes the parental condition. And to me, our society is getting too far away from parental connection. And that's why I oppose this bill.
Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I appreciated the discussion in the public hearing on Tuesday, but it was also really, it was difficult and troubling for me, you know, frankly. Just, you know, starting from, you know, the discussion of this therapy as, you know, what was called reparative therapy. You know, I find that actually obnoxious, actually, I'll just say that the notion that somebody who is gay needs to be repaired You know, I just find that very offensive. And, you know, I think as many of us are, a lot of our attitudes on this issue are based on people we know or people we're related to, people we love. You know, I have a niece, you know, who married another woman last summer, and it was, you know, it was really a wonderful event. And she's a wonderful person. She's a physician. She is, she's not damaged, you know, or, you know, somehow, you know, she's in a sound condition. And so, you know, the very premise of, you know, what's known as reparative therapy, I think is not something that the state should be supporting. I know that times have changed, and probably methods around this practice have changed. But, you know, I'm old enough that I remember some really, really offensive practices around this. You know, one of, I remember when I first started college, okay, this was a long time ago, you know, in the late 60s, I had a resident advisor who, you know, as it turned out, was gay, and he, you know, it was very difficult for him to come out publicly, you know, with his sexual identity, and he didn't. I mean, it was just some of us knew that about him, but, you know, those were heady times, and, you know, in the late 60s, and there was a real movement to, you know, be open and, you know, honest, and he did become open and honest about who he was, lost his job as an RA, and his, he had a breakdown around it, which led to his going into a program that his parents put him in, and the program worked in that he had a girlfriend. He was heavily sedated. I think he'd had electroshock was part of the therapy, and he was not himself anymore, and he was kind of a zombie, to be honest, and it was a terrible, terrible thing. And I realize that the techniques are different today, but the basic premise, I think, is the same. And, you know, it's, I think, you know, we heard in the public hearing that the science is not clear around this technique, but I think if you do look at the statements from, for example, the American Psychological Association, you know, it's very clear that, you know, that the belief that the way that somebody, that individual should be treated is not by means of this therapy, that this therapy is not successful, and it is, you know, it's really counter what good professional counseling should be. So, therefore, I'm in strong support of this bill.
Thank you. Senator Montanerson.
Thank you. To me, the most important thing is to love and to protect our youth. And they should never be coerced or put into treatments that are going to lead to depression, that are going to lead to decreased self-esteem, that will lead them maybe into substance abuse or suicide. To me, each individual needs to be protected and loved. And I firmly believe that this bill does not affect religious or non-licensed counseling. Anyone, whether they're a licensed professional from working with a counselor in a church, can still be working with youth who have a conflict on their feelings of who they are. So I'm very much in support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. So I, too, am in strong support of the bill. I was really taken by the testimony that we had on Tuesday. I really haven't stopped thinking about it since then. Like Senator Dembrough, I was deeply moved by some of it, hurt by some of it. I know that some of the things for everyone in the room were difficult to hear on both sides of the issue. I think what's important about this bill, an issue that keeps coming up, is shouldn't teenagers be able to talk with people if they are questioning their sexual identity, if they have questions about these feelings that they're having? And of course they should. And this bill does nothing to take that away. They can still go to a counselor. They can still say, I'm having these feelings and I'm very comfortable with them, or I'm not comfortable with them, or I don't know what they mean. The idea behind this is that the counselor, as consistent with good therapy practice, has to be focused on that individual and that individual's self-directed goals without some sort of an idea imposed on them. I think to the parenting issue, I am a parent. I have 4 kids in this age group at home. Well, actually, my son is 20, so I have 3 kids in this age group at home. And I can think of a whole host of times where I've known that my children need something. They have a need, or they have a want, or they have a hurt. And I don't know what that answer is. I don't know what they need, and I turn to a professional, and I listen to them and their guidance about how to get there. This bill would allow me to do that. But what it would not allow me to do as a parent is to put my own ideas on top of the identity of my kids. I got a couple of emails asking me, how would you feel if one of your children told you that they were gay or lesbian? What would you do? Wouldn't you want to have this therapy available? And I would not. If one of my children were to tell me that they were gay or lesbian, I would say, great, I love you. What are we having for dinner? Do you want to talk about it or not? I mean, it would be, my children are who they are, and I want them to always know that whoever they are, the most important thing to me is that they are happy and they are healthy and they are true to themselves and they don't have any shame about who it is that they are. And I've thought about that since they've been little. One of my favorite hymns in my church actually is called, I attend a Lutheran church. It's called, I Was There, You Were There to Hear My Morning Cry, and it's kind of God following you all the way from birth. But one of my favorite lines is, I hope you find a person with whom to share your days. I'll be there to make your verses rhyme. And I always have loved how beautiful that was, and from the time they were infants, I loved how inclusive that was, that what that was saying to them and what I hope I've always said to them is, I hope they are able to pick the person that they love, and as long as they're good to them, that is the only thing that matters. And I wouldn't want to subject them to something that would put them in danger, that would make them feel shame or make them feel that I didn't value them exactly the way that they were. So I am really happy to be supporting this bill. I hope other states follow suit relatively quickly. Any further discussion? Oops, seeing none. Maria, would you please call the roll?
Senator Dembrough?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Mondes Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
No.
Aye. The motion carries, and the bill will go to the floor. I'll be the carrier.
Yes, before you gamble.
Yep. See, I remember.
Give notice of a possible minority report.
All right. So Senator Olson gives notice of a possible minority report. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2307A and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2363.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2363 requires clinical record of seclusion or confinement of a person alleged to be mentally ill who is in the custody of a hospital or other facility. It declares emergency, is effective on passage. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral. Came off of the House floor 4316 and out of House Committee 69.
Great. And we've got Bob Judith. We're all trying to get our computers to pull the bill up.
Yeah. Well, after that emotional discussion, this hopefully will be not as fraught.
An uplifting discussion about seclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, cheer us up.
Hanky's here, I see. Thank you very much, Chair Gelzer, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I am the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. The bill before you today...
Would you talk into the mic a little bit more?
Oh, sure. Although, if you get too close, it does funny things.
Okay.
So maybe make sure you're speaking up,
okay,
too, so everybody can hear.
Sure thing.
And you're welcome to come closer, too, if you need.
All right.
Okay. The bill before you deals with the topic of civil commitment. And civil commitment is a law that we have that allows people to be taken into custody if they are considered to be a danger to themselves or others, or unable to provide for their basic needs as a result of a mental health problem. During the when a person usually is held in a hospital setting, More and more often these days, a person may stay in the emergency room of a hospital because there are so few psychiatric beds available in a hospital, which means that during the 5 judicial days during which a person is to be evaluated to determine if they should go to court to have a hearing to determine whether they should be civilly committed or not, they may never even make it to a psychiatric bed. They may spend that entire time in an emergency room. And sometimes in the emergency rooms, that means that they can be held in a room by themselves. Usually they will have psychiatric care in those situations, but not necessarily depending upon the environment. But so we do have laws around this about what level of care and treatment a person can expect to receive or is mandated to receive while they're being held involuntarily during that period of time. And the law that we have says that those individuals are to receive the regular and customary care, custody, and treatment that a person would receive who's been admitted to a hospital. But it adds, in addition to that, that electroshock therapy and other what's termed unduly hazardous treatments are not to be used during that period. And it has one other requirement, and that is that if the person needs to be physically restrained, and by physical restraint, I mean using belts or tie-down mechanisms to keep a person attached, usually to a bed, can be a chair, that needs to be documented in the medical record over the signature of a mental health professional. And I'd say that what this recognizes is that there are situations in which that intervention has to happen, but it's so intrusive and it can be dangerous that as part of the authority that is given under the law, that it's felt that that should at least be documented by a medical professional. The bill before you would add a documentation requirement for seclusion. And what seclusion means is when an individual is placed in a locked room and is unable to leave by themselves. That's generally what the term means. And when seclusion was first used as a technique, there wasn't a sense that this was a dangerous type of activity. It was just a way to keep people safe or keep a person confined. But what we've learned as the years have gone by is that being in isolation does have negative consequences for people, particularly people who are experiencing psychiatric crisis. And you may have seen this discussed in the context of schools, in the context of youth correctional facilities, adult correctional facilities, and also in mental hospitals. For years, it's been a trend in psychiatric hospitals to try to minimize or eliminate the use of both seclusion and restraint. In fact, Salem Hospital here was one of the pioneers in being able to accomplish that in their facility and in our state hospital, they are working to decrease the use of seclusion restraint. They certainly haven't eliminated it, but I receive the data monthly showing how their efforts are going, and there's ongoing training and efforts to do that, because it's recognized now that seclusion itself can be harmful for people and can be traumatic for people, particularly those who are experiencing psychosis. And so we felt it was appropriate to add the documentation requirement to the law, to say that if seclusion is used and applied, that it be documented in the medical record. We believe that this is a requirement of CMS in medical facilities, but having it in state law and recognize that as a use of that in commitment, which is a use of governmental power to hold a person against their will, that it's appropriate to have that safeguard. And that is why we brought the bill to you for your consideration.
Thank you. So, Bob, we have a letter in the record from Multnomah County Health Department about whether or not this would apply to jails.
Senator Gelzer, the jails are not facilities that are certified to provide hold. It's called hold to house a person during a hold period, and so a jail would not be applicable in these situations.
And what would, so we had a situation in my region recently where trying to figure out how to describe this without violating confidentiality. So there was a person, and the person had been arrested for a crime and was being held in a jail. The individual was trying to harm themselves, so they were taken to the hospital. The hospital wouldn't take them because of the nature of their prior crimes. They were not able to be held anyplace else, so they were taken back to the jail, where they were tied down to a plastic chair for many, many, many hours. And the jail staff expressed concern that that was not appropriate. So are there things that happen in jails where a mental health professional might be contacted in a case? And the jail was really in a bind because nobody would help. And if the person was not restrained, that person was going to take their own life or mm-hmm. someone else's. So mm-hmm. what if that's not an appropriate hold and a person can't kind of skip past go and go to a psychiatric bed at the state hospital because a local hospital won't take them, what protection is there for them?
Chair Gelzer, this brings me back to law school. This is a good question. My assessment of the situation you just set out is that let's start with the civil commitment law. The civil commitment law allows a person to be placed on a hold by a court, two individuals, or a physician or a police officer. And when a person is brought for admission to a hospital, the hospital has certain obligations to admit under certain circumstances. I think the first question that arises in my mind is whether the hospital was justified in turning the person away. I would submit that if that person needed inpatient psychiatric care at that point, that the hospital had an obligation to admit at that point, with the caveat that the hospital also has to make an assessment as to whether it can safely house an individual. So this brings us to topic number two, which is that in our civil commitment law, there's a prohibition against holding a person in jail pursuant to a civil commitment hold. But there is an exception, the same one I just mentioned, that if a hospital believes that they cannot safely hold an individual, that person can be housed in jail.
Well, the person was in jail for a crime.
Right. And that brings me to point number three.
Okay.
Going through the analysis. is that it makes a big difference as to what the governmental authority is for holding a person. So if a person is legally being held in a jail, then all the rules at the jail pertain to that person, not the rules that would apply to civil commitment. The rules for civil commitment only apply if that's the legal justification for holding a person against their will. So in that circumstance, a person is entitled to, in jail, is entitled to medical services that meet constitutional standard. And what that standard is depends upon whether it's pre-conviction or post-conviction. So if it's post-conviction, it's the Eighth Amendment, which is cruel and unusual punishment, which is a very low bar for the jail to hop over, but it is a bar. And if it's pre-conviction, you move up to the 14th Amendment, where you get a little bit more protection. So thank you for the law school questions.
Maybe I'll do that in my next life. Is there, Senator Olson?
Thank you. Could you explain to me, as a novice, someone comes in and they're disruptive and they're in obvious mental distress, without restraint, how does Salem Hospital hold them down to maintain and so that they don't hurt themselves or hurt other people?
Their staff are trained to engage with that individual and to divert the basically through for people who are just coming in and being assessed. There's different situations. People who are just coming in and being assessed, they will try to engage the individual and move them to a portion of the facility that is in which there isn't anything that the person could hurt anybody else or themselves, and they're trained in what are called de-escalation techniques, and so there's and they've proven to be quite effective. But there are individuals who can be so violent at a particular time, then that intervention is necessary. But they're relatively rare if the person's handled correctly. Dr. Maggie Bennington Davis, who I think is the clinical director at Trillium right now, she was with Cascadia before and she was at Salem Hospital right now, would be a great witness to have on this topic because she was the person who directed that program, and I am a mere lawyer.
Follow up. But if the person was very disruptive, mm-hmm. and they had to restrain or had to mm-hmm. put them in seclusion, what this bill does is say that you need to record it and document it so that we have a record for the medical staff.
Correct. The perspective is that intervention should be a medically directed act. And that doesn't mean that a staff member can't act to protect themselves and intervene at that moment, but then that needs to be reviewed by a doctor and approved by a doctor or appropriate medical professional. So the idea is to make sure that these are clinically tracked rather than being an activity that occurs outside of the medical practice.
And this is a hypothetical, of course, but someone comes in and they're disruptive and there's not a mental health physician on staff at the time, and the nurses or whoever staff mm-hmm. is available makes the decision to restrain. Mm-hmm. What would happen to those people if the doctor said, I don't think you should have restrained him?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, what normally happens, as I understand it, and again, I don't work on those wards, is that given the staffing patterns, what normally happens if an intervention is necessary, the intervention happens, and then it's reviewed with the appropriate medical person. That might happen by phone. There are requirements in CMS rules in terms of how quickly a person has to be seen, what I would, if a doctor were to review that and say, you know, this really was not an appropriate intervention. I would imagine that there might be some training or disciplinary action taken within the facility for that staff member.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbro, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. So, you know, again, this bill just really deals with the documentation aspect, right?
That is correct.
Requires documentation. It seems pretty innocuous to me, and I was surprised when I looked at the floor vote to see that although it was strongly supported, there were 16 people who voted against it. Was there a discussion of why there were problems with it? Nobody in the public hearing, I noticed, nobody signed up to speak against it.
We did circle back with some of the representatives who had concerns, and my best understanding of their concerns is that...
You're okay.
Is that there is a sense that there is sensitivity to regulation of the medical profession by the government, and feeling that this was an act of regulation, and sort of as a general perspective, did not want to add an additional requirement onto an exercise of medical judgment.
I got no problem. Let's move the bill.
Is there any further discussion? Thank you for asking that question. I was wondering the same thing. All right. Thank you, Bob. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2363 and open up a work session on House Bill 2363. Senator Olson.
I'm just looking to see why they would even a doctor vote against it. I can put rules in there that explain why they did.
Vote explanation.
Yeah. It's almost more of a judiciary type bill than.
Yeah. Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2363 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair also moves House Bill 2363 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I just have a question. Was there, and I should have asked Bob Joondiff this, was there any opposition to the bill in the House? I mean, you're the only one signed up here, but there was a whole lot of material. Oh, I'm probably looking at the wrong bill.
It's mostly from Bob.
Yeah.
Will you say your name one more time for the record?
This is Bob Joondiff, Disability Rights Oregon. Chair Gelser, Senator Mons Anderson. No one testified in opposition to the bill. I think the concerns arose during work session. And for the reasons that I mentioned, as far as I know.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to this bill? Seeing none, the bill heads to the floor. Senator Cruz, do you want to carry this one?
Sure.
All right. So Senator Cruz will carry, close the work session on Senate Bill 2363, open a work session on House Bill 2473.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2473A allows the Board of Licensed Social Workers to adopt rules on temporary licensure, including establishing fees. It declares an emergency is effective on passage. Came unanimously from a House committee and off the House floor. No revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, no subsequent referral.
All right. And we have Randy Harnish, please. Welcome back. You've been here once before.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Randy Harnish, and I am the Executive Director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers. And we have the opportunity to fix a simple problem this afternoon with this bill. One of the issues, as was recently or previously stated, this bill would authorize our board to issue temporary licenses. One, the clearest example, and I actually had a call this morning where this was the topic, was regarding our licensed clinical social workers. There is a precursor status called the Clinical Social Work Associate, which is akin to an internship that an applicant must complete before getting the full clinical social worker license. That clinical social work associate has many several requirements, one of which is a plan of supervision. In other words, the social work associate is working under the direction of a fully licensed clinical social worker in a work setting for a period of time, accruing experience hours and supervision hours with that supervisor. This process of obtaining a plan of supervision has turned out to be a classic catch-22. You can't get a plan without a job, and you can't get a job without a plan. And so we have recent graduates who have to kind of jockey and arrange putting together potential employment in order to put together a potential plan and then have everybody sign at the dot. It's kind of like closing on a house. Everybody has to get together and sign everything at one time, and then it works. What we would like to be able to do would be to authorize the board to adopt a temporary license that an applicant would be eligible for upon completion of all of the paperwork and all of the, you know, transcript, paying the fees, everything, up to but not including the plan of supervision. At that point, issue them a temporary license, which would allow them to go out, present that to their employer, work up a plan of supervision, bring that back to us, at which point their plan of supervision, once approved, would the temporary license would go away, and their permanent CSWA, Clinical Social Work Associate license, would be issued. We don't see that this would require any additional funds. It would really require no additional paperwork because it would be just a midpoint, a step along the already existing process. It's almost too easy, and I have to knock on wood to think that this is going to work the way I envision it. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked about the associates. Why do you need a temporary licensure for a clinical social worker?
Well, the way the bill was drafted is it would allow us to apply this temporary status for any of our license categories if an issue were to arise. There are situations currently where this bill, if it becomes law, would allow us to address, for example, someone who comes in fully licensed from another state, and our process requires them to complete some additional paperwork. We may be able to allow that person to move into practice more quickly with a temporary license while they accrue that additional material necessary for that license, the clinical social worker license, to be issued in Oregon. Now, that's just an example, but those are situations that we are presented with on occasion. The CSWA was the easiest example and most pressing example of how the board might use this authority if it was granted.
Other questions, Senator Denberg?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. How long do you see these temporary licenses lasting, Randy?
Senator Gelzer, Senator Denberg, I can't imagine that they would last more than 90 days. I think, again, as I kind of envision the board developing rules, if they can't complete and design and implement a plan within that period of time, there are probably other issues that need to be addressed, and the plan is not the biggest problem. So I would envision it being fairly short term.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on House Bill 2473? Nope. Going. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2473A, opening a work session on House Bill 2473A.
Chair Gilster, you ready for me?
Yes.
Chair Gilster, I move House Bill 2473A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
That was too good of a straight line.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2473A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. I was asking Senator Amanda Sanders if you want to carry.
Sure, I'll carry it unless the social worker Chip Shields wants.
Is he a social worker?
Mm-hmm. He was.
I didn't know that.
Let's keep it in the family.
He sells
yeah,
oil.
Yeah, put me down.
Okay, so Senator Amanda Sanders will carry it. Okay, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2473A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2694.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2694 permits the Department of Human Services social workers to report suspected animal abuse or neglect as a function of their employment, provides immunity for social workers acting in good faith, and it applies retroactively. This came off of the floor 45 to 15 and out of House committee unanimously. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal.
Thank you very much. Georgia Coolidge, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society. The Oregon Humane Society is Oregon's largest and oldest animal welfare agency. We've been in existence since 1868, and we have no affiliation with any other statewide animal agency or any sort of national humane society. Here in support of House Bill 2694. The Oregon Humane Society, on top of, we do up over about 10,000 adoptions every year. We do have two other very unique functions in the state. The first is we have a fully operational medical facility, and every graduate of the Oregon State University Veterinarian Medical Program is required to do a mandatory 2 weeks at OHS, so they get really first hands-on work in a hospital, working on a variety of different animals before they graduate, and we have a full set of dorms that they stay in when they finish their time up at the Oregon Humane Society. The second thing we do is we have a law enforcement agency, a humane investigation agency, and we have commissions through the governor's office and are in the process of transitioning that to the Oregon State Police, where we assist law enforcement agency across the country. But predominantly across the state in helping them with their animal abuse crimes. You know, and this has been something that law enforcement has been very open and welcome to, certainly being able to sort of partner with a sheriff or a state police officer who's doing a person crime that includes elements of an animal crime, to be able to turn that animal crime piece over to us. Has been sort of beneficial, and we do that at absolutely no cost to the state. It's all relied on private donations that come to OHS. We brought House Bill 2694 to you today primarily because one of the things we hear is we get cases for our law enforcement folks through sort of either local sheriffs or law enforcement, like I said before, calling us. The other thing is we do get complaints from the general public, and we have heard and talked to some social workers who say there are a number of cases that they see when they go out on working for the Department of Human Services where people would like to report. And what we decided was, you know, we wanted to make it a voluntary process. It's not a mandatory reporting, but that they could make the report with being able to do so without being sort of liable criminally or civilly. And sort of the case that we always sort of say is, you know, a person goes out to an apartment complex and they, you know, to assist an individual and happen to notice that, you know, a back room or something has a number of dead cats or dead dogs or something like that, and that they now can report that to law enforcement who can go out and investigate. I hate to say that, you know, since I know this committee has been working bills through quite quickly today, but as I was reading it, and I apologize to the committee for this, I do see a need for an amendment to the bill. Right now, as you see in line 23, a report can be made to law enforcement agency or an animal rescue entity. Our intention of this bill is allowing the social worker to report to a law enforcement agency. The animal rescue entity is pretty broad. It includes rescue groups, includes humane societies, adoptions, kind of across the board. I would request an amendment where we actually delete animal rescue entity and we make it apply only to law enforcement. We think that law enforcement is best situated to be able to deal with the complaints that come in, understand, you know, what's animal abuse, animal neglect from, you know, something otherwise. And so I would hope that you will take the time to support House Bill 2694 and but carry it over until we can get that amendment and then bring it back before your committee.
And have you, has somebody written a note and requested that amendment? Do you need us to request that amendment?
Actually, I was in the back talking to, I don't know if he's still here, Mr. Beyer, and I said, you know, I didn't notice this before, and I don't think we meant to include that, and crossed it out, and so I would, either from the committee or if one of the members could give me a note, that would be great.
No.
Or can you request it?
Go home.
All right, so chat with Shannon. Thank you.
Yes.
Counselor. The wise person to my right.
That's what you get for talking to buyers. You should never do that. So.
Are there any questions?
I do have a question. Go ahead. What was the dispute on the other side? Because I got a note that this was a bill of concern.
15 no's.
I would say it was Chair Gelser, Senator Olson. I think it was sort of similar to what my good colleague Mr. Junduff was saying before, as it came out of committee unanimous. There was a concern that we have been sort of maybe over-regulating some of the animal issues, and there was, you know, some particular concern is, does this take away from, you know, sort of the people issues when a social worker does go out? So I believe those were the two sort of general concerns that I heard on the floor.
Follow up? It wasn't anything about an extension of neighbors spying on neighbor?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, no. This, I think you were referring to as another bill that is currently sitting in Senate Judiciary regarding nuisance and animals.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbro.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You know, I do think it's natural for social workers to look at animals. You know, if they're, you know, let's say if they're visiting a foster, you know, if it's a foster care setting or something where there might be some, you know, vulnerable individuals there, often the way that an animal is treated can be an indicator of other problems. So, you know, I could see that sort of heightened sensitivity. So, you know, I think that this does make sense. I wonder, you know, in terms of not contacting the animal rescue entity, if, you know, I mean, if an animal is in danger, is, you know, if there might be an occasion where that might be appropriate. So I'm just wondering, is the natural course of events, do you think, that law enforcement then would come and intervene, and then, you know, if they decided these animals needed some emergency shelter or something, you know, then they have protocols for doing that?
Chair Gelser, Senator Dimbro, yes. I think that's sort of why we wanted it to only apply to law enforcement. I think you're right. I think, you know, what we have seen is more acknowledgement between human crimes and animal crimes, and I know there's studies more coming out of Department of Corrections, you know, of people in there for various crimes, and are there a correlation between animal crimes. But, you know, law enforcement has the ability to sort of seize an animal that's in distress. You know, and if we have a situation, you know, like I said before, a report by a social worker is made, you know, to law enforcement. You know, law enforcement can come if they see, you know, an immediate need where, you know, under some of the allowable, I think, exemptions, so like the warrant requirements or whatever of an animal in severe distress, then they would have the protocol to be able to seize that animal. And I know that there are a number of groups that sort of work with law enforcement that do that. The Oregon Humane Society, we actually have part of our shelter is sort of a secure facility that you know, that we work with a lot of sort of local in the Tri-County areas when animals are seized for, you know, specific reasons under law enforcement, that they can be housed there in a protected facility. So I think that was one of our concerns with opening it up to like an animal rescue entity who wouldn't have, I think, the statutory authority to be able to seize an animal, and, you know, would probably either do one of two things. Either would, it would be an extra step. You know, I'm sure if Willamette Humane Society got a call, they'd probably immediately call Salem Police or State Police. But, you know, there is a concern with some of the maybe more active animal groups that somebody would take a proactive and say, I'm going to go out and see what's happening. And in that case, those people don't have the statutory authority to seize an animal or to do anything. And it might create an unnecessary problem that if we could be avoided if it was just limited to law enforcement.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you. Anderson?
I don't know if this is pertinent to this bill, but you know how we're given trainings on reporting for abuse, child abuse primarily. I don't think I've ever gone under a training for animal abuse, and I was just curious. I, as a public health nurse, had a blind woman who had dozens of cats. I had to go in, actually, to the first time I went and visited her. Her fingernails had grown maybe 6 to 10 inches long. I mean, she just never could cut her fingernails. And there was someone that came in to feed the cats once a week. But all these cats, and, of course, you know, the hygiene was pretty poor. Is there a line on where it's animal abuse or animal neglect? I mean, are there trainings out there? I was just curious.
Chair Gelser, Senator Monis Anderson. So I can't speak to, you know, some of the specific training that the social workers go through. I do know on the House side, we did have a representative from, I don't know what it's, I think it's the Oregon Social Workers Association or whatever the appropriate group is called. They did testify in support of the bill. I think we are seeing, like I said, as I said before, as we're sort of understanding the correlation more between, you know, animal and people crimes, and we see it, I think, more frequently with, you know, more child abuse and animal abuse crimes. I think we're seeing more resources available to people who are involved in this. I know certainly, yeah, you know, the Oregon Humane Society does do a lot of additional training. There's some national programs that are put together and by veterinarian groups of identifying when, you know, animals go from, you know, being malnourished to when they're starved and stuff like that, and it's a very medical process. And I believe, you know, they work with Oregon State Police and other groups. So, folks who are involved in these particular incidents are more aware of defining what that is, rather than, you know, a good animal husbandry practice being caught up. But I could not speak to whether there are additional classes or anything being taught. I mean, it's sort of evolving, I guess.
Madam Chair, yes. Senator Monis Anderson, I could help clarify. The bill enables the reporting, but the person who's on site isn't making a determination. They make the report to a professional, and the professional makes a determination
right.
if it's accurate.
No, I knew that. I was just wanting for general knowledge what, you know, where the line is between neglect and abuse versus.
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Senator Monis Anderson, I'd be happy to get information for you.
Thank you. So any further discussion? Thank you, George.
Sure.
Anybody else want to be heard? Roger Beyer, welcome.
Somebody wake him up back there.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. And I was also asked to put on the record the same comments regarding for the Oregon Farm Bureau. So I think some of the questions you have asked, especially the questions asked by Senator Anderson, gets to the issue of why the dairy farmers. And I can't say necessarily that we have concern, or maybe it's concern but not opposition. I don't know what the right term is. But the amendments that were just talked about, or the proposed amendment, will certainly make this bill a less objectionable bill when you take the animal rescue entity piece out of it. But the issue is that most people and who are not trained in animal husbandry and normal animal management practices that are practiced on dairy farms and other livestock operations around the around Oregon, what may be a normal animal husbandry or normal animal management practices, some people might think is animal abuse. And that's the concern when you have untrained people who are now not mandated, but this bill will be encouraging them to report what they think are suspected animal abuse cases. And the dairy farmers are just concerned whenever we see that kind of a practice, because many times the general public, untrained people, just aren't aware of what happens on normal livestock operations, which is perfectly legal, perfectly normal, and it happens every day. So that's the concern we would put on the record. If the bill, most of these bills as they've gone through this session, have exempted normal animal husbandry or normal animal management practices, this bill does not do that. I don't know how you would do that in this piece of legislation. As I said, the amendments that that George and I talked about in the back of the room will make the bill better, because the concern, I think, that if law enforcement is called, they are trained people who know those practices or know more about those practices versus animal rescue entities. We see those potential just advocates who would just be trying to make a case. So I'm not saying we oppose the bill. I'm just trying to put some concerns on the record. Maybe some floor statements about these practices could help with our concerns. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair, first time I've been in front of your committee, and I never thought that I would be in front of your committee talking about a bill for the dairy farmers. I must say that caught me by surprise.
It's the first thing for everything, right?
Absolutely.
Senator Montes Anderson?
You bring up an interesting thought. So I don't know. Do they brand cattle with an like those iron things anymore? You know how each ranch has their own symbol and they would brand them in, and some people said, oh, that's animal abuse. Now I know they clip the ears, but none of that's considered animal abuse, correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Montes Anderson, you are correct. Ranchers still routinely brand cattle with hot branding irons. They put ear tags in their ears. They cut notches in their ears. Dairy
they
farmers.
They sound like Portlanders.
dairy farmers do not traditionally brand their cattle with a hot branding iron. They do use the ear tags, and they sometimes use chemical brands on them that make permanent marks on their skin. And those are not considered animal abuse. Those are normal animal husbandry practices or normal animal management practices. But to a common person driving down the road or going into a worker's cabin for a social visit on a ranch that sees that practice may think that it's animal abuse, and then that subjects that rancher or that dairy farmer to a visit from the local sheriff or the so that is exactly the concern. You talked about it earlier, but a very common practice in dairy animals is pregnancy checking. Some people, if they're driving by or don't know that, and they see someone standing at the rear of a dairy cow, they might think that that person is doing something inappropriate, when in fact that is not inappropriate at all. That is a normal animal husbandry practice. So those are the kind of issues we are concerned about, exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody else want to be heard on this bill? Any further discussion? All right, so we are going to get that amendment back. So we won't do the work session today. We will bring it back. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2694. Thank you again, everybody, for staying late the other night. We're now even on the time.
Close, though.
I'm going to adjourn.